felt quite that way before, he recalled. Within 48 hours, paralysis had spread to his limbs, thumbs, toes, back, bladder, and rectal sphincter. Pain shot up and down his legs. Misdiagnosis by the first attending doctors accelerated his dire condition. Fear, confusion, and persistent agony followed. Finally, a specialist was summoned who correctly diagnosed his condition. Poliomyelitis, a virus that attacked the nerves controlling muscular activity. In the days that followed, Eleanor, with the support of Franklin's assistant Lewis Howe, a guest at Campobello, lifted him off the bed onto a bedpan. She administered enemas and learned how to use a catheter. The doctor mandated complete bed rest, save a daily tub of soothing warm water. For weeks, Franklin lay in bed, unable to perform the most basic bodily functions on his own. He had sustained a fundamental blow to his body, to his identity as a man and a human being. Until the acute phase passed, no predictions could be made about the subsequent course of his illness. Some muscles might return, others would recover only partial strength or remain totally paralyzed. In mid-September, he was transferred from Campobello to New York Presbyterian Hospital, where he remained for 6 weeks. While his bladder and sphincter muscles returned, his shoulders remained remarkably weak. His back could not support a seated position, and his legs showed no response at all. The physicians generally concurred that he would not walk or stand on his own power. Neither Eleanor nor Lewis Howe believed he would ever be able to use his legs again. Upon discharge, the chart read, "Not improving." The poet Koltsov, referenced by Turgenev in the story Death, asks, "What if a falcon's wings are tied? What if all ways are to him denied?" It was this dreary future of dependency and obstruction that this graceful falcon of a man was now forced to contemplate. Loss of uprightness, deprived of the stamina and appearance of strength which political leadership seemed to demand. Franklin Roosevelt's ordeal provides the most clear-cut paradigm of how a devastating crucible experience can, against all expectation and logic, lead to significant growth, intensified ambition, and enlarged gifts for leadership. The trajectory he had envisioned as a 25-year-old, the large figure he longed to cut in the world, climbing from the state legislature to Assistant Secretary of the Navy, up to Governor of New York, and then to the presidency itself, had in all likelihood been derailed. Months and years of striving lay ahead of him, accompanied by fear, anxiety, and concealed bouts of depression. But eventually, the sustained effort Roosevelt directed towards spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical recovery led him to a spectacular, albeit risk-filled, return to public life. Roosevelt's irrepressible optimism, his tendency to expect the best outcome in any circumstance, provided the keystone strength that carried him through this traumatic experience. From the outset, he set an objective, a future in which he would fully recover. Although necessity forced him to modify the timetable for attaining this goal, he never lost his conviction that he would eventually succeed. Roosevelt's physician, Dr. George Draper, feared that his remarkably upbeat patient would be unable to cope once he fully understood the gravity of his situation. During his hospital stay, Roosevelt was always smiling and cheerful, casting a genial glow of positive jocularity onto his visitors. In letters and conversations with friends, he predicted he would be upright on crutches by the time he left the hospital, walking without a limp by the following spring. Then it was simply a matter of time before he could resume playing golf. The psychological factor in his management is paramount, Draper told a fellow doctor. He has such courage, such ambition, and yet at the same time such an extraordinarily sensitive emotional mechanism that it will take all the skill which we can muster to lead him successfully to a recognition of what he really faces without utterly crushing him. Dr. Draper was not the first to miscalculate the resourceful depths of Roosevelt's character. Appearing bright and happy had been the expected pattern of behavior in the Roosevelt household in the wake of the heart attack that left his father an invalid. The changed dynamic at Springwood, a defense fashioned to protect Mr. James from worry or anxiety, had demanded secrecy and duplicity. Franklin's letters from Groton sparkled with reports of how splendidly he was getting along with his classmates, when in reality, he was lonely, ill at ease, and having difficulty fitting in. Now, in the face of traumatic illness, Roosevelt brought these old patterns of behavior to bear in a more powerfully nuanced way than ever before. The positive image he projected, so starkly incongruous from the ordeal he was confronting, was not simply to protect others, but to buoy his own spirits. Some days were harder than others. In time, however, the steadfast affectation of good cheer begot real cheer. If there was something contrived and theatrical about the relentless sunniness he conveyed, a willful whistling in the dark, he radiated warmth, hope, and confidence that would, in the end, prove contagious. Fueled by resolution, perseverance, and newly acquired patience, he set forth on the tortuous journey to reclaim his rebellious body. Told that his upper body had the greatest likelihood of recovery, Franklin endured punishing exercises to salvage and remake his chest, shoulders, neck, arms, and back. In a manner more grueling than any bodybuilding of Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin did everything possible to solidify the intact remnant of his physical core. Hour after hour, he pulled himself up on a set of rings installed in a trapeze-like contraption above his bed, slowly and painfully strengthening his muscles until his upper body came to resemble that of a champion boxer or wrestler. With powerful arms, he could finally manipulate a wheelchair and push himself into a sitting position. Everything below the waist, however, remained a goner, according to one of his doctors, preventing him from getting into or out of the wheelchair without assistance. Day after day, he would ask to be lifted from the wheelchair and set down on the library floor so that he could further exercise his back and arms by crawling around the room. He then proceeded to tackle stairs, grabbing railings on either side with his hands, hoisting up his body step by step to the top, sweat pouring from his face. He insisted that family members be on hand to witness and cheer on each of these triumphs. And with every small win, Eleanor observed, Franklin felt stronger than before. He regained his joy in living, she later wrote, his hearty laughter, his ability to be happy over little things. The day he was at last able to move one of his frozen toes called for a grand celebration, creating a shared mood of joy and happiness. When asked during his presidency how he dealt with continuing problems, he half-jokingly observed, "If you spent 2 years in bed trying to wiggle your big toe, anything would seem easy." Each increment of increased mobility led to the possibility of new progress. After being fitted with heavy steel braces to keep his legs rigid, he met the laborious challenge of learning to totter awkwardly on crutches. Through it all, he adamantly refused to relinquish his ultimate goal of walking on his own. In his never-ending search for treatment, Roosevelt deployed a trial-and-error method, an indelible fingerprint of his leadership style. In the Navy Department, he had flung ideas against the wall to see which ones might stick. During the New Deal, he would experiment with one program after another, swiftly changing course if the present one proved ineffective. Now he enthusiastically embraced dozens of novel contraptions. An electric belt, an oversized tricycle, a specially designed shoe, a children's double swing. Over time, he invented his own devices to deal with a number of mechanical problems that obstructed his mobility. He designed a small wheelchair without arms to exercise his quadriceps and fastened pincers to a stick to reach his library books. He had the first hand-operated throttle and brake installed in his motor vehicle. And all the while, he carried out an extensive correspondence with his fellow polios, as he addressed them, comparing ideas for overcoming common dilemmas. The shared vulnerability revealed in these letters represented the first flowering of a new humility of spirit, a concern for the pain and suffering of others that would later grow to maturity during his years at Warm Springs, Georgia. Far more than the sum of its parts, the unorthodox, fiercely loyal, and intimate team that Franklin assembled during his 7-year convalescence, comprised of Eleanor Roosevelt, Lewis Howe, and Missy LeHand, became an extension of Roosevelt's body. Together, they functionally diminished the isolating impact of his paralysis. We have seen how Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt reassembled and reinvented themselves in the wake of their crucible experiences. The nature of Roosevelt's paralytic polio was such, however, that he had to depend on others as he fought to recover his physical and mental strength. This highly talented team dedicated their lives to serving his purposes, as Eleanor once said. Simultaneously, he manifestly served their purposes. For Franklin's long period of recovery and transformation was also a time of metamorphosis for all three members of the core team, a time of realignment and growth, a time when they discovered previously undeveloped interests and talents of their own. Both Eleanor Roosevelt and Lewis Howe recognized from the outset that Franklin's spirit would be destroyed if his political ambitions were throttled. If he didn't have political hope, they believed, he would die spiritually, die intellectually, and die in his personality. Working side by side, they mobilized a strenuous campaign to sustain his political dreams. Anxiously at first, and then with genuine enthusiasm, Eleanor took on the task of keeping her husband's name alive in political circles. She served as his surrogate at public events, joined various Democratic Party committees, volunteered for the victorious gubernatorial campaign of New Yorker Al Smith, and spoke at luncheons and dinners. Having little experience in public speaking, her son James recalled, she gave more than 100 practice speeches to an audience of one. Her mentor and coach, Lewis Howe. Howe taught her to restrain her nervous giggle, lower her high-pitched voice, say what she wanted to say, and then sit down. When she began to speak before packed audiences, Howe would sit in the back row using a series of hand signals, similar to those Lyndon Johnson would employ with his debate students, to indicate where she was reaching her audience and where she had fallen into nervous mannerisms. Before long, she was recognized as a powerful speaker. Entering public life proved a liberating force for Eleanor. Her marriage had foundered 3 years earlier, upon her discovery of a packet of love letters to her husband from a young woman named Lucy Mercer. When Franklin pledged never to see Lucy again, Eleanor agreed to remain in the marriage. From that moment on, she later told friends, she no longer loved him in the same way. Though they remained joined by unbreakable ties and retained a deep and unshakable affection and tenderness toward one another. Now, in the wake of Franklin's paralysis, she could serve her husband's initiatives and simultaneously forge a role for herself. In the course of her political activities for Franklin, she joined a circle of progressive feminists dedicated to abolishing child labor, passing protective legislation for female workers, fighting for the minimum wage and maximum work hours. She further developed the leadership trait she had exercised during her days as a star student in boarding school, organizing people, inspiring them to loyalty, articulating their goals. She was stirred once again by the ambitions that had been curbed by the responsibility to care for a husband and five children. With his paralysis, new opportunity had opened up, whereby she might aid him and realize her own dreams of leaving a mark on the world. Franklin's paralysis transformed Lewis Howe's world in equally dramatic fashion. For nearly a decade, while married with two children, Howe had served as Franklin's secretary, advisor, and friend. Franklin's illness, Howe told an interviewer, changed everything. From the moment his boss was stricken, Howe never lived with his family again, choosing instead to make the Roosevelt family his own, visiting his wife and children only on occasional weekends. He had his own room at the Campobello Cottage, the New York townhouse, the governor's mansion, and ultimately, the White House. He had one loyalty in life, and it was a kind of religion, White House speechwriter Sam Rosenman said, Franklin D. Roosevelt. He courted politicians on Franklin's behalf, held private conferences with Democratic governors, mayors, and congressmen, attended local and state party conventions, and put together a twice-weekly roundup of interesting articles and gossip about politics, business, and world affairs, creating, in effect, a newspaper designed for a readership of one, Franklin Roosevelt. Father was too busy with his fight for his life to think of his political future, Roosevelt's son James said. According to his biographer, Howe's solution to balance the two priorities, Roosevelt's physical well-being and the resumption of his public life, was to lift one of them off of his shoulders. Howe's belief in Roosevelt's destiny was a matter of faith. Soon after Franklin was stricken by polio, when Eleanor queried Howe as to whether her husband could navigate the rough-and-tumble world of politics, Howe assured her that nothing had altered his belief that one day Franklin would be President of the United States. Meanwhile, Roosevelt continued to pursue his own consuming vision of full recovery. While grudgingly he agreed to wear the cumbersome 20-pound braces and practice using crutches, he never stopped searching for a cure that would allow him to regain the power of walking, the necessary condition, he believed, for him to fulfill his political ambitions. He continued the arduous task of experimentation to figure which treatments worked most effectively. He found that his leg muscles responded more quickly when he could sit outside in the summer sun. On cloudy days, they would freeze up from about 5 p.m. on. In swimming, he found the most promising therapy of all, one allowing him to exercise his legs without the weight of gravity. Roosevelt held an almost mystical belief in the healing power of sun and water. He had been enraptured from early childhood by sea tales of his grandfather's clippership days, thrilled at learning to sail with his father, and considered his model ships and naval prints among his most prized possessions. Not surprisingly, his relentless search for a cure led to the halcyon waters off Florida, where he spent the winter months cruising on the Larucco, a spacious houseboat in the company of the third member of the team, 25-year-old Missy LeHand. "Water got me into this fix," he mystically quipped, referring to his dip in the ice-cold Bay of Fundy. "Water will get me out again." Unexpectedly, Missy LeHand would play as vital a role in Franklin's restoration as either Eleanor or Lewis. Eleanor had accompanied Franklin on his first Florida cruise, but she detested the listless days occupied by fishing, entertaining guests, and simply relaxing. "Far better for everyone," Eleanor believed, and in some large part rationalized, "that Missy should remain with Franklin in Florida while she herself returned to New York to cultivate prospective political allies and pursue the network of new friendships that had grown central to her own social and intellectual existence." Thus, Missy became Franklin's other wife. Over the next 4 years, Roosevelt spent a total of 116 weeks in the South. Of that total, Missy accompanied him for 110 weeks, Eleanor for 4 weeks, his mother Sarah for 2. Missy gave F.D., as she called him, unconditional devotion. Like Lewis, she was absorbed into the Roosevelt family and would live in both the governor's mansion and the White House. The early months spent on the Larucco allowed Franklin to evade the martial rigor of the exercise regime prescribed by his doctors, giving him time to explore his own idiosyncratic routines. Holding the boat's tiller, he could feel the surge of control. He floated in the warm waters, lowered from the side of the boat by contraption of his own contrivance, and bathed in the sun. Missy sat by his side as he fished from the deck, served as his hostess when guests regularly came aboard, and shared his sense of nonsense in a way Eleanor never could. Storytelling, fun, and humor were as central to Roosevelt's well-being as to Lincoln's. But even more important than the role Missy played in sustaining Franklin's high spirits was the fact that he was able to reveal to her his darker fears. "There were days on the Larucco," she later told his Secretary of Labor, Francis Perkins, "when it was noon before he could pull himself out of depression and greet his guests wearing his lighthearted facade. Slowly but surely, those bad days began to dwindle." Roosevelt would replicate the strengths of this inner circle in the years ahead, as he expanded his working team as governor and president. There was not a yes man woman among this original triumvirate. They offered Roosevelt a range of opinions, delivered in widely different ways. From the earliest days of their relationship, Lewis Howe had never hesitated to argue with Franklin. According to Rosenman, Howe probably said no to Roosevelt more frequently and loudly than anyone else, and stuck to his position longer. Missy handled dissent in a more fun-loving but equally effective manner. In addition to her various gifts as typist, companion, and hostess, she was an astute reader of Roosevelt's moods and needs, never hesitating to tell him unpleasant truths or express an unfavorable opinion about his work, yet always with a deft sense of timing and always in a way he could handle. During one of his campaigns, she was in the room while Roosevelt read aloud from the draft of a tedious speech on finance to be delivered at Pittsburgh's Forbes Field. Before he reached the second page, Missy stood up. "By this time, the bleachers are empty and the folks are beginning to walk out of the grandstand." Everyone burst into laughter and the speechwriters started over from scratch. Eleanor, of course, added the most essential dimension to the progressive strain and moral gravity of Franklin Roosevelt's leadership. "He might have been happier with a wife who was completely uncritical," she observed in her memoirs, adding, "That I was never able to be." She was more uncompromising, more straightforward, more deeply involved with activists whose thoughts challenged conventional boundaries. His political timing and overall comprehension of public sentiment was far more astute than hers. If he balked at something she wanted, she would return to try again. If he would not meet with someone she thought it imperative for him to meet, she would take it upon herself to invite that person to dinner. I sometimes acted as a spur, even though the spurring was not always wanted or welcomed, she later wrote. Her constant pressure and lack of humor made it difficult for him to relax. We're not going to do that now, he would often cut her short. I don't want to hear about that anymore. And yet invariably, he would return to her unwanted suggestion, realizing before long that her persistence might well have been warranted. This remarkable team, locked together in a complicated dance around the same center, succeeded so well in keeping Roosevelt's spirits up and his political name alive that in 1924, 3 years after the onset of polio, Governor Al Smith proffered Franklin Roosevelt the New York chairmanship of his pre-convention campaign for the presidency. Roosevelt hesitated at first, feeling far too vulnerable to appear in public. But when told they simply needed his name, not his body, he agreed to become titular head of the campaign. 2 months later, Governor Smith presented Roosevelt with a far more unnerving and challenging proposition. Would he consent to place Smith's name in nomination at the Democratic National Convention to be held at Madison Square Garden in late June? If ever there were an example of political courage, of an enormous risk taken, of great personal and public stakes wagered, it was Roosevelt's acceptance of Al Smith's offer, given the looming prospect of a pratfall in front of 12,000 delegates. That Franklin had not yet mastered the technique of walking with braces and crutches had been made clear months earlier, when he ventured forth for the first time since the polio attack to meet with business colleagues at a private luncheon on Wall Street. An elevator would carry him upstairs, but first he had to cross a slippery marble lobby to reach the elevator bank. With his chauffeur's assistance, he had reached the halfway mark when a crutch skidded out from under him. He collapsed in a heap, his hat rolling off to the side. Appalled spectators gathered round as he tried to prop himself into a seated position. "Nothing to worry about," Franklin announced to placate the onlookers, bursting into a sudden peal of laughter. "We'll get out of this all right." He then called for help from two young men who eventually pulled him to a standing position. "Let's go," he said to his chauffeur. Someone put his hat on his head. Cheerfully, he acknowledged the crowd and made his way toward the elevator. The convention speech was to be his first public appearance in 3 years. It was one thing to fall in a lobby, quite another to risk humiliation and jeopardize one's political ambitions at a national party convention that would be broadcast nationwide for the first time on radio. To minimize the immense risk, he carefully rehearsed and trained. "Nobody knows how that man worked," Eleanor's suffragist friend Marion Dickerman recalled. "They measured off in the library at the 65th Street house just what the distance was, and he struggled and struggled and struggled." With the support of his 16-year-old son James, he alternately shifted his weight from his son's arm on the left to the crutch under his right arm. James remembered how his father's fingers dug painfully into his arm, like pincers, as he hoisted and dragged his legs, locked in heavy steel braces, along the narrow line between potential pity and awe, toward the imaginary podium. On the night of the actual performance, Franklin directed a friend to shake the rostrum in order to assure him of its weight-bearing stability. When his moment of introduction came, he replaced his son's arm with another crutch and approached the lectern alone. There was a hush, and everybody was holding their breath, Francis Perkins recalled. After what seemed like a long-drawn moment of tension, he reached the rostrum, handed off his crutches, gripped the lectern edges with his powerful vice-like grip, tilted back his head, and across his face there flashed a vast, world-encompassing smile. 12,000 voices exploded with admiration for the courage he epitomized even before his speech had begun. This was a far cry from the unfortunate habit of throwing his head back when he was in the state legislature, a gesture that had seemed condescending to Perkins, the unconscious mannerism of a handsome and entitled youth. Now, by contrast, his stiffened legs and strained shoulders supported a head thrown back with hard-earned pride and perhaps a touch of theatrical confidence. Rather than vanity, this was the confidence of having overcome fear of humiliation, a confidence born of making a great effort, of taking a great risk, and overcoming. His rich tenor voice had a musical quality as he asked delegates, "From the great cities of the East and the plains and hills of the West, from the slopes of the Pacific and from the homes and fields of the Southlands, to close divisions between city and country, wet and dry, Catholic and Protestant, and unite behind Governor Al Smith, the happy warrior of the political battlefield." This epithet, drawn from a Wordsworth poem about how one confronts life's difficulties, how one, doomed to go in company with pain, turns his necessity to glorious gain, would, from that moment, forever affix itself to Al Smith. With striking force, however, it succinctly described Franklin Roosevelt himself. Seated in a front row, Perkins observed that he was trembling and shaking from the extreme pain and tenseness with which he held himself up to make that speech. But his delivery was strong and true and vigorous. He stood as the living emblem of a man who had truly transformed his own pain and necessity into glorious gain. When he finished, according to Eleanor's friend Marion Dickerman, the crowd just went crazy, igniting an hour-long demonstration. They howled, yelled, screamed, and sang from densely crowded galleries, the Hagerstown, Maryland Morning Herald reported. "I have witnessed many heroic deeds in my lifetime," the reporter for the Syracuse Herald wrote, "but I never was present at so fine a display of mental courage." It little matters, the New York World editorialized, if Governor Smith gains the nomination. He would lose on the 103rd ballot. For the real hero of the convention is Franklin Roosevelt. Adversity has lifted him above the bickering, conflicting personal ambitions, and petty sectional prejudices. Indeed, the hard-boiled Kansas City boss Tom Pendergast opined that if Roosevelt had been physically able to withstand the campaign, he would have been named by acclamation. "He has the most magnetic personality of any individual I've ever met." Later that evening, Eleanor hosted a reception at their New York house. Exhausted but exhilarated, Franklin kept to his room. When Marion Dickerman went to see him, he held out his arms and he said, "Marion, I did it." Though 4 years would pass before Franklin returned in earnest to his political vocation, this speech was a vital way station. That he had made great progress was evident by this trial balloon, but his greatest growth as a man and as a leader lay ahead, on a road that led through Warm Springs, Georgia. The story of Warm Springs, the pioneering rehabilitation center Roosevelt built from a ramshackle resort, begins with his discovery of a place where he believed he would learn to walk again. Instead, he experienced a different kind of recovery, developed a more profound level of humility, and provided inspiration for and was inspired by the vibrant community he created with his fellow polios. Told about a spa in Georgia where a young man had restored strength to his legs by swimming in a giant pool fed by mineral water that gushed from the hillside at a soothing 86 degrees, Roosevelt journeyed to the Merriweather Inn to find out for himself. His initial impression of the once popular resort was not heartening. Almost everything was falling to pieces, Roosevelt later recalled. The turreted wooden hotel dilapidated, and the roofs of the surrounding cottages leaking. But the buoyant water of the T-shaped thermal pool delivered on its promise, allowing him to exercise his muscles for an extended period of time without throbbing fatigue. "Every morning I spend 2 hours in the most wonderful pool in the world," he told a friend. "There is no question this place does more good than all the rest of the exercising put together." Within a matter of weeks, he had a hunch that a great cure for infantile paralysis and kindred diseases could well be established here. He envisioned a renovated hotel with bright sunny rooms, spruced up cottages, a medical staff of doctors, nurses, and physical therapists, along with a host of recreational and social activities designed to let the patients live normal lives and at the same time receive the best treatment known to science at the time. Furthermore, the place he imagined held out the curative promise of the great European spas he had known so well as a child, without the trappings of wealth. Here was therapy within a rustic and democratic simplicity. Meditating years afterward on Roosevelt's leadership strengths, Francis Perkins marveled that there were times when he could truly see it all, when he instinctively understood how one decision or one undertaking related to another. Warm Springs was such a time. That he was able to turn his initial vision into a combined resort and treatment center that would accommodate hundreds of patients and their families revealed a surprising entrepreneurial flair. Against the advice of his wife, mother, and friends, he decided to invest $200,000, roughly two-thirds of his fortune, to buy the hotel, the springs, and the cottages along with 1,200 acres of land. This would be the first major project he administered completely on his own. Deploying a hands-on, dogged leadership, he worked with architects to build a completely accessible campus, dispensing advice on remodeling the hotel and the surrounding buildings. In addition to his role as consulting architect, Roosevelt served as landscape engineer, provided suggestions for manicured lawns, oversaw the planting of trees and flowering garden arrangements. He designed the layout of golf courses, riding trails, a dance hall, and a movie theater. During the construction phase, he drove around encouraging the crew with a contagious zeal, just as he had made the rounds with his father surveying the various construction projects at Springwood. He staffed the facility with great care. Recognizing the importance of support from the medical establishment, he persuaded the American Orthopedic Association to create a research protocol to measure outcomes and deliver a report. When the report proved positive, he placed the entire enterprise into a nonprofit foundation. This allocation allowed him to raise additional funds to carry out improvements and to make provisions for those who could not afford the full fare, making a reality of his initial democratic impulse. He became known as Old Doc Roosevelt head counselor, spiritual director, vice president in charge of picnics, and therapy pioneer, all rolled into one. He directed morning exercises in the therapy pool, and then led patients to a separate pool where they laughed and shouted as they engaged in swimming contests, played tag, and water polo. During the afternoons and evenings, there were bridge tournaments and poker games, classes, movies, excursions, amateur theatricals, as well as festive cocktail parties and dinners. He aimed not merely to restore the bodies of the patients, but to return the possibility of joy and pleasure to their lives. "We mustn't let the fun go out of our program," he insisted. "We've got to make these patients more alive every day." He took pride, he told the reporter, in having created a remarkable spirit of cooperation and competition among the patients to see who can improve the most, adding that the spirit of the place has an extraordinary effect on the progress they make. Here they find people just like themselves. They get over their self-consciousness. While micromanaging this grand scheme for almost 4 years, Roosevelt underwent what Perkins has called a spiritual transformation. An old priest had once told her that humility is the first and greatest of virtues. If we don't learn it on our own, the Lord will surely teach it to us by humiliation. The humility Roosevelt learned at Warm Springs was of a different order than merely accepting one's limitations. By sharing those limitations with his fellow polios, by listening and learning from them, he had, Perkins believed, purged the elitist aura that had once surrounded him. He emerged from the experience completely warm-hearted, with humility of spirit and with a deeper philosophy. He had developed a powerful new empathy, allowing him to connect emotionally with all manner of people to whom fate had also dealt an unkind blow. He had inspired the entire Warm Springs community with his optimistic spirit, infusing his fellow polios with his own indomitable courage. It was, one patient recalled, a place which changed forever our feelings about ourselves and the man who made this possible. And he, in turn, had experienced the intense fulfillment of linking his ambitions to the betterment of others, of creating an institution from the ground up that would serve for generations as a model for the treatment of people with disabilities. At Warm Springs, he had found a cure different from what he had initially sought. He had come to restore his ability to walk, a condition he thought requisite to run for public office. He knew that no one so paralyzed had ever been active and successful in politics. Could a propped-up leader, a wheeled or carried leader, lead and uplift? Were crutches antithetical to American command? He knew the answers to those questions now. He had developed a different concept of leadership. The deep affection and respect accorded him from the shared community he had created at Warm Springs made it clear that a polio victim who needed help to walk was fully able to exercise leadership of the highest order. He had made a separate peace with his recovery, and in his heart was ready to recommence with a life fully in the public glare. Opportunity knocked in 1928, when Al Smith, having won the Democratic nomination for president, pressured Roosevelt as a service to both the party and himself to run for governor of New York. The Roosevelt name, Smith figured, would boost voter turnout in a state that had to be won. All the Democratic Party hoped from Roosevelt, Smith assured him, were 4 or 5 radio addresses to strategically punctuate the month-long campaign. As soon as the campaign was done, Roosevelt could turn over the heavy lifting to the lieutenant governor and return to Warm Springs and recuperation. While Al Smith had rightly calculated the impact of the Roosevelt name in New York, he had badly miscalculated the man himself. Once Roosevelt had agreed to be drafted and assumed the responsibility of running for governor, he was in it for keeps. "When you're in politics, you have to play the game," he told a friend. He resolved to prove to himself and to the public that he had the physical vigor and the capacity for sustained hard work that would outstrip any ordinary campaign effort. Often speaking 14 times a day, he delivered 33 major speeches in 30 different venues, together with scores of informal talks and clusters of meetings. "It was a dreadful physical business to make this campaign," Perkins observed. "He really was kind of scared." As she watched him being carried up a fire escape to enter a third-floor hall, a perilous, uncomfortable ordeal, she said to herself, "My God, he's got nerve." Moreover, he accepted his humiliating entrance with grace and dignity. He was good-natured with everyone, conserving his strength by never complaining about small things or wasting time over trifles. "If you can't use your legs and they bring you milk when you wanted orange juice, you learn to say, 'That's all right,' and drink it." Roosevelt eked out a narrow victory in the gubernatorial race, but in the national election, Smith went down to defeat when a Republican wave swept Herbert Hoover into the White House. Stunned by the devastating loss, Smith retreated to Albany, determined to be the power behind the governor whose nomination he had engineered at the Democratic State Convention. Just as Roosevelt had not waged a token campaign, however, so he made it clear during the transition that he would not be a proxy governor. Shortly before Christmas, Roosevelt later recounted, "Al came to see me and told me that Mrs. Moskowitz, Bell Moskowitz, Smith's political manager and chief aide, was preparing my inaugural address and message to the legislature. Honestly, I think he did this in complete good faith, but at the same time with the rather definite thought that he himself would continue to run the governorship. His first bad shock came when I told him I had already prepared my inaugural address and that my message to the legislature was nearly finished." Roosevelt faced a second challenge to his independence when Smith strenuously recommended that he appoint Bell Moskowitz his chief secretary. Brilliant, dynamic, and domineering, Moskowitz had been as indispensable to Smith as Lewis Howe was to Roosevelt. Roosevelt promised to consider her appointment, but in the end, after much waffling, patter, and calculated delay, he balked. "I realize that I've got to be governor, and I've got to be myself," Roosevelt explained to Francis Perkins, who would serve in his cabinet in Albany and as his labor secretary in Washington. When he first agreed to run, he recalled, he wasn't sure if he could handle the rigors of the campaign. "But," he proudly noted, "I made it." Nor had he been certain that he was sufficiently recovered to undertake the duties of governor of New York. "But here I am." Roosevelt's rejection provoked an irate response from Smith. "I created you, and now what are you doing to me?" This brutal personal struggle at the start of Roosevelt's term as governor, Eleanor recalled, ended the close relationship between my husband and Governor Smith. Formulating his own team in his own way was particularly important for Roosevelt because, as he had realized early on, his team would be a vital extension given his restricted mobility, its members serving as his eyes and ears, going forth into the field to localities he could not easily traverse, gathering information in the form of stories and human anecdotes that would animate issues and problems. When the narrow corridors and stairways of state institutions for the blind, the aged, the insane, and the deaf made it difficult for him to navigate, he encouraged Eleanor to go as his surrogate, to glean information and return with insights on how well the institutions were carrying out their stated missions. At first, my reports were highly unsatisfactory, Eleanor acknowledged. I would tell him what was on the menu for the day, and he would ask, "Did you look to see whether the inmates were actually getting that food?" She learned to sample pots on the stove, notice if beds had been folded up and placed behind doors to hide overcrowded sleeping quarters, observe the patients' interactions with the staff. These were the details her husband craved and taught her to discern. Before long, under Roosevelt's mentoring, Eleanor became a first-rate investigative reporter, becoming so adept it was as if he had secured the data firsthand. Roosevelt sought team members whose experiences and specific knowledge amplified his own far-flung curiosity. "He was endlessly educable," said Francis Perkins, at the time his commissioner of industry. "He filled the governor's mansion with a steady stream of visitors from all walks of life, who joined him at lunch, dinner, and frequently stayed overnight. If he couldn't go out into the world, he would funnel the world into him." Having been away from state politics for a decade and a half, he asked Sam Rosenman, a young lawyer who had recently served 3 terms in the state legislature, to be his counselor. While Rosenman was considering Roosevelt's offer, the story of his appointment appeared on the front page of an Albany newspaper. "I made up your mind for you," Roosevelt gleefully informed him. Rosenman was not offended. How could one resist such affability? Soon he became one of Roosevelt's closest advisors, so intimate that Franklin and Eleanor invited him to move into the governor's mansion. Long afterward, Rosenman asked of his boss why he had been willing to place such a young man whom he barely knew into such a close and confidential relationship. Roosevelt replied, "I get to know people quickly, and I have a pretty good instinct about them," adding, "Sometimes that instinct is better than a long and careful investigation." To shore up Roosevelt's knowledge in various pertinent fields affecting his prospective agenda, Rosenman recruited 3 Columbia professors, Raymond Moley, Rexford Tugwell, and Adolph Burley, to form the nucleus of what would become known as the Brain Trust. This inner circle, in turn, reached out to experts in various fields, business, agriculture, labor, who then filled the governor's mansion with a parade of interesting and useful guests. Soon, expanding circles of experts revolved around the governor, as a little Ptolemaic universe around the earth. "The routine was simple," Ray Moley recalled. "The atmosphere at dinner would be pleasant and casual. Roosevelt encouraged his visitors to talk about their work, their families, and themselves, making each person feel that nothing was so important to him that day as this particular visit, and that he had been waiting all day for this hour." Dessert done, they moved to the governor's small study, where random talk came to an end. There, Roosevelt would throw questions to the experts at an exciting and exhausting clip. As the night wore on, the questions became meatier, more informed, the infallible index to the amount he was picking up in the course of the evening. Moley marveled at the amount of intellectual ransacking Roosevelt could crowd into the evening. From hindsight, it was clear to Moley that Roosevelt was at once a student, a cross-examiner, and a judge. The Depression did not fall upon the land like a moonless night. Even as the stock market was thriving, there were signs of a darkening and protracted twilight. The very operating method Roosevelt had devised from the beginning of his governorship, sending people out to inspect and retrieve information while simultaneously bringing in a stream of selected experts, sensitized him early on to the fact that something was fundamentally wrong. From Perkins, he learned of a puzzling irregularity in the labor market. Many people were out of work for longer periods than was comfortable. When an inspection of the State Public Employment Service revealed many of its undermanned offices were overwhelmed by applicants, he called for an overhaul of the system, a small but important step before the October 1929 stock market crash. As usual, Roosevelt was galvanized into action by way of the stories of specific needs and grievances. He could understand a problem, Perkins realized, infinitely better when baffling statistics and facts could be translated into a human story. Upon visiting a sweater mill in a small village near Poughkeepsie, he found both the owner and workers frightened and confused. Before the crash, the mill had employed 150 people, making high-quality knitted sweaters. The workers received good wages, the owner made a good profit, and the community thrived. As the Depression deepened and demand fell, the owner was forced to halve his work, reduce wages, and use a lower-quality yarn to produce cheaper sweaters. He kept the mill going as long as he could, even to the point of foregoing any personal profit. He lived in the village. His employees were friends. Still, demand continued to plummet and was soon insufficient even to cover costs. This small sweater mill, which was eventually forced to close, served as an emblem and an allegory to lend a human dimension to the abstract economic term, the descending spiral. Roosevelt had no overarching remedy for handling the Depression. He began with piecemeal solutions, trial-and-error methods to spread available jobs to a greater number of people, part-time work, a shortened work week, a reduced workload, small make-work community projects. What was clear to Roosevelt, Perkins recalled, was that we must find some answers and stimulate some immediate activities. Although he mobilized charities to respond, coordinated local relief efforts, and called on local towns and cities to use their borrowing capacity to the fullest, the growing magnitude of the Depression burst the bounds of all these institutions. After waiting through the winter and spring of 1931 for federal initiatives from President Hoover and the Republican administration, Roosevelt resolved in late summer to assume leadership for himself and to take action for the state of New York. He summoned the Republican legislature into an extraordinary session to pass what was then considered a radical idea, a state-sponsored, comprehensive program of unemployment insurance. He knew from the start that the Republican majority would block his proposal. Like President Hoover, the state Republican leaders believed that private enterprise, charity, and local governments were the sole institutions capable of meeting the economic challenge. Relief brought from the distant level of the state or federal government, they insisted, would only impair the enterprise of the American people and worsen the problem. Roosevelt spent several days preparing his message to the legislature. He had schooled his speechwriters Rosenman and Moley on how to communicate to the people at large in order to circumvent the legislators. Avoid dull facts, create memorable images, translate every issue into people's lives, use simple everyday language, never use big words when small words will do. Simplify the concept that we are trying to construct a more inclusive society into we are going to make a country in which no one is left out. What is the state? Roosevelt began. The state was created by the people for their mutual protection and well-being. One of its central duties is to care for its citizens who are unable, through adverse circumstances, to maintain their lives without help. In normal times, such aid would be provided by private or local contributions. But these were not normal times. The prolonged unemployment had exhausted the savings and credit of millions of families. The state had a responsibility to do its share. not out of charity, but out of duty. He called on the state through a tax on citizens fortunate enough to be able to pay, to provide public work for its unemployed citizens, and, if no work could be found, to provide unemployment insurance in the form of food, clothing, and shelter from public funds. The Republican leaders rejected the bill. They substituted what the governor termed a wishy-washy measure and prepared to adjourn. Roosevelt threatened to veto the bill and to call the legislators back into a second extraordinary session until an effective bill was passed. Finally, the Republican leaders yielded. First in the country, New York's comprehensive relief program became a model for other states, establishing Governor Roosevelt as the leading spokesman for the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. In a celebrated radio address in April 1932, Roosevelt called on the country to rebuild its lost prosperity from the bottom up and not from the top down, to put their faith once more in the forgotten man at the bottom of the economic pyramid. For Roosevelt, that image was not merely an oratorical abstraction, as Sam Rosenman had directly witnessed. The forgotten man was a living person, a farmer facing crushing debt, a small businessman unable to compete against monopoly, a housewife incapable of making ends meet. Roosevelt's hands-on leadership style, tireless search for information, and demand for stories that enliven statistics with the flesh and blood of a shared humanity had acquainted him with the suffering and distress of individuals and afforded him a visceral understanding of the impact of the Great Depression. Cast as a voice for the common man, Roosevelt sought the nomination for president at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Despite a substantial majority of the delegates on the first ballot, Roosevelt fell 104 votes short of the two-thirds total then required for nomination. His opponents represented the old guard conservative wing of the Democratic Party. Standstill prevailed through two additional ballots, but after much wrangling, the Roosevelt forces finally broke the deadlock. It was agreed that John Nance Garner of Texas would be nominated as the vice presidential candidate. In return, both the Texas and the California delegations would switch to Roosevelt, pushing him over the magic two-thirds number. No sooner had he received word that he had won on the third ballot than Roosevelt took the unprecedented action of traveling to the Coliseum to accept the nomination in person. Tradition had dictated that a committee chosen by the convention, visit the winning candidate in a leisurely month or 6 weeks to deliver official notification. Roosevelt decided to break with what he later called the absurd idea that he should remain for weeks in professed ignorance. Instead, he provided a novel, bold, activist approach to leadership. At a time when airplane travel was still uncommon, he flew from Albany to Chicago in a trimotor plane. Conventional methods and old remedies would not help the country now. He had come in person to show that he was ready and eager to lead the battle against inaction, timidity, and hidebound thought. "I pledge you, I pledge myself to a new deal for the American people," he concluded. "This is more than a political campaign. It is a call to arms." The battle between Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt illuminated how strikingly different characters, temperaments, and leadership styles responded to the enormous stress and uncertainty of the country. Both men had been progressive protégés of Woodrow Wilson. As Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Roosevelt had urged the Democratic Party to nominate Hoover for president in 1920. An enlightened businessman who had served with spectacular success as head of the Commission for Relief of Belgium during World War I, Hoover was deeply respected by both parties. In 1928, the Republicans nominated him for president. In his acceptance speech, delivered at the height of prosperity, Hoover proclaimed that Americans were nearer to the final triumph over poverty than ever before in the history of any land. His profound belief in individualism, voluntarism, and the fundamental strength of the American economy blinded him from realizing until too late that government had to exert a primary role in helping people through what was fast becoming the worst depression the country had ever known. At the slightest uptick in the stock market, Hoover believed and summarily proclaimed that the worst was over. When the economy continued to flounder, he came under blistering assault. Still, he would not admit the voluntary activities had failed. He adopted a bunker mentality, refusing to countenance the worsening situation. By contrast, Roosevelt had adapted all his life to changing circumstances. The routine of his placid childhood had been disrupted forever by his father's heart attack and eventual death. Told he would never walk again, he had experimented with one method after another to improve his mobility. So now, as Roosevelt campaigned for the presidency, he built on his own long encounter with adversity. "The country needs, and unless I mistake its temper, the country demands bold, persistent experimentation. It is common sense to take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it frankly and try another. But above all, try something." On election day, by an overwhelming majority, the people chose Franklin Delano Roosevelt as their president. In a time of national duress, it was Roosevelt's confident cheer and powerful shoulders, symbols of his resilience, that made it possible for the common people not only to believe and trust him, but to identify with him. As a young man, Franklin had daydreamed of ascending step by step to the presidency, but that narrative had been disrupted by paralysis and warm springs. There can be found the unlikely fulcrum point of both his ascent to the White House and his activist, experimental, and empathetic leadership. He had come through a dark time, and so would they all.
Chapter 8.